Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Monday edition. A little bit later in the program, we will talk to Randy Schaefer. She is a digital news editor at the Chicago Tribune, and we'll talk to her about a number of things. One of the stories she pulled was suggestions that when you're starting to date, when you're new in a relationship, that you shouldn't friend the other one very soon. You should wait until you're on your own sort of stable footing. You like the person well enough before you start to see what she's been posting or he's been posting. We'll talk to Randy about that. As I said earlier, the president of Ozinga Concrete, Marty Ozinga, will come in as well. And right now, though, we always start on Mondays with a visit from Chicago Inno. Karis Husted and Jim Dahlke are in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
All right, so not too long ago, a couple of hours ago, the Supreme Court ruled it lifted a stay on much of President Trump's travel ban. And they will hear the full ruling or full hearing in October. But for now, this is a big win for the Trump administration. We talk a lot here about the tech world and about how they want freer immigration, not more restricted. It seems, though, the Supreme Court will allow people to come in from these countries as long as they've got a job or some connection. It seems like the tech industry might, what is it, a half full bottle here or what is it? Are they happy with this?
So the good thing is that if you already have a formalized relationship, if you are connected with a university, say a researcher, or you have a job at a startup or a tech company, you can still come in. So there is just a big H-1B lottery. Those people are all okay. If they're coming from one of those six countries, they can still come into the country and have that job. I think what is going to be the bigger issue is moving forward, what effect this has on people coming to the United States or founders who are looking to hire people from these countries or people who want to found a startup in the United States from these countries.
So if you're in the pipeline, you're okay for now. But the idea is if you're looking to grow, this still is going to have sort of a chilling effect.
Yeah, so maybe short term, maybe the impact isn't so big, but there certainly could be the impact could be felt in the long term, especially as we sort of slow down immigration into the United States for these technology companies, and especially as people think about immigrating, maybe they choose Canada over the United States, where the things might be a little more easier and a more welcoming environment for some entrepreneurs. So it's definitely an issue that the tech community is keeping a
close eye on. I think it was with you guys last week I mentioned Macron is really reaching out in France, making it clear that these people are welcome in France. France has certainly had its problem with the tax, more so even than the U.S., but they're bringing people in with the idea that, okay, if you're inhibited or worried about coming to the U.S., come to Paris and we'll make good there.
Yeah, and I think the founder issue is like the really key thing to think about here, because it's not just filling jobs, you know, that people, you know, are really talented at and can do here, but it's also about who's creating the companies that will create more jobs.
Right.
So half of the unicorns, which are the billion-dollar companies in the United States, have a foreign-born founder. So, I mean, you have to think about it's not just who you're letting in for a tech job now, it's what startup are you preventing from starting here in future.
And I don't want to argue the whole immigration ban thing, but if you think of it, if you have a family member here, you will be allowed in. And off the top of my head, a number of the attacks that were carried out by people who traveled in came in to visit family or had family members here. So, okay, there's that. Enough of that. You guys are focusing on Chicago and cancer research as well. And we've talked about Eric Lefkofsky before, but he's got some big data he's working on, a very personal cause for him, and he's willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars for it.
Exactly. Yeah, this is sort of kicking off a week-long Cancer Innovation Week that we've got here at Chicago Inno. And one of the initial stories we have is on Tempus, which is Eric Lefkofsky, the former Groupon founders and CEOs, his next venture, which launched just a couple of years ago. And Tempus is really taking this big data approach to help personalize cancer treatments. So taking a look at what initiatives, what treatments were effective for people with specific tumors, using that information to give that to future cancer patients.
So the idea is if it's all about data, let's collect the data on cancer and refine people's treatment.
Exactly. Basically, the data around cancer treatment was completely siloed. It was all over the place, and they're trying to bring it into one platform to help physicians better treat their patients. So basically, Eric's effort here is completely self-funded. He's willing, like you said, to put hundreds of millions of dollars, which he feels really puts them at an advantage. They're not out scrapping for fundraising. They have the funding that they need to kind of build this thing to as fast as they can. They've got over 150 employees now, sort of many of which are data scientists, kind of taking a look at these genomic sequencing.
We've been talking about them for a while. Where are they? They're still building, right?
They're still growing. They are seeing patients right now through the door. So they've partnered with about a dozen cancer treatment centers who send their patients to get sequenced down at Tempus. So they're seeing people every day. I mean, it's an interesting idea, right? Like, you won't know the success of Tempus right. until like kind of down the road. We'll see how their sort of tailored treatment options work towards people's treatment.
Measure success, it's not going to be you're not going to say, well, Jane was cured. I mean, you might. But more, it's going to be a sort of a bigger curve when it comes to sort of looking at how they do.
Exactly. And that's sort of the tricky thing with a like venture-backed cancer startup, you know, because if you know, you're funding these companies and investors want to see return on that investment, they want to see metrics of success. Tempus being self-funded, being that Eric Lukofsky does have, you know, a net worth of $1.7 billion thanks to Groupon and other right. endeavors, he can kind of really put his money into Tempus and really sort of grow this thing and start to make a real measurable dent in cancer treatment.
And you guys are having similar looks all week long, right, at Cancer in Chicago?
Yeah, another one we actually did today was looking at University of Chicago's Genomic Data Commons.
Talk about big data.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, this is the largest repository of cancer data in the entire world. I mean, so this is just research from the National Cancer Institutes, from all over the world, 14,000 patient cases, basically bringing all of the siloed data, as Jim was talking about, into one place so researchers can access it.
And so is Chicago must not be alone in doing this, and Lukofsky must not be alone in doing it, right? Are there? I hope there's not competition here.
You know what? Competition is there. There are other companies doing this, and the competition is welcomed, right?
Like
the more competition we have here, the more likely we are going to get to sort of find the answer to how this data can be used.
But they can
treatment.
Share data without competing against each other, right? I mean, I guess several different collection areas.
So Tempus, for example, gets its data from its partnering cancer treatment centers, right? So they're partnering with the University of Michigan, the Mayo Clinic, University of Northwestern, UChicago. And so they're working with those kind of organizations to share data. So it really depends on can the cancer startup get the connections that it needs to get the data that it needs.
That is Jim Dahlke. Kars Husted is here as well from Chicago Inno. And we'll throw a little audible because you guys send me stories every morning about what we want to talk about. You just sat down and said, there's a new story that was just announced. I don't know if it's up on your website yet, about a handyman service.
It is, yeah. We covered it just this morning. The co-founder of Grubhub, Mike Evans, has a new startup. He left Grubhub back in 2014 after co-founding it in 2002. And he's back with a new startup called Fixer, which is on-demand handyman. Handyman to your door in under an hour. So if he was sort of launching with Grubhub with on-demand food, now it's on-demand toilet repair.
Okay, so I think I like this idea. I think this could be a really good idea because I've had occasion to hire a handyman. And when you do, you want sort of a reference or you want someone who's going to, you know, stand behind them. So this would do that, right? And then the other thing you're always worried about is not how much, but is it a fair price? Because you never know who's charging what else. So if it's, again, a standard like this, it probably would be a little reassuring.
Yeah, right now they're charging $80 an hour.
Oh, that's too much. Forget it.
And what they're doing is they don't round to the hour. So if they're there for 10 minutes, they're not charging you $80. They're going to prorate that for the 10 minutes that they were there. So that's right. Kind of an interesting thing. And so right now it's private beta. So they're still, you know, it's only invitation only. So they are Chicago-based, which is great that he's keeping another startup here in Chicago. So early days for Fixer, name of the company. And so we're still yet to see kind of how it will grow. But kind of cool to see that the co-founder of one of Chicago's most successful technology companies is on to this next thing.
Yeah, I think – go ahead, Kars.
Yeah, and he had kind of an interesting journey to get there. Grubhub did its IPO, he actually did a cross-country road trip on bike and sort of did a blog chronicling his time there. So I always think it's kind of fun when a startup founder has success, decides to do something completely different, and then just goes in a whole new direction.
Yeah, it shows it's more about the creativity than the actual initial idea. Right, more about the process of all of it than just about restaurants and food. But I think the key, well, there are a couple of keys. One is you want someone to stand behind it. So there's that, you'll feel better. But the other is you said that, so if my kitchen blows up the day before I'm having a dinner party, I'll have a handyman over within an hour.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of a frustration that you get when you're trying to, you know, have a handyman come to your house, that you're kind of on their time. You know, they've got X number of visits to make, like throughout the day and throughout the week. And so, you know, they give you a window of time that's maybe 4 hours or 6 hours long or however. I mean, this is going to give you a little bit more of peace of mind knowing like, hey, someone's going to come in less than an hour right now to fix my leaky faucet. So pretty interesting to kind of see him take that approach.
And they're not, so I can't hire him today.
You can request an invite. So yeah, you can take part in their beta test right now. I don't think they've got a timetable on their site quite yet, but you'd imagine that in the coming months that they'll roll this out throughout Chicago.
Pretty cool, maybe too, if you're a handyman, because it will allow you to a way to really tap into business.
This was a big part of the mission for Mike Evans to say, you know, we don't. This isn't just gig work. This is for. I mean, these aren't contractors. These are full time employees. So they want to provide a steady stream of work for contractors, for handymen, and give them you know, the kind of benefits that you would get with a full time employee job, not just a contractor.
Yeah, and I believe they're also bringing in apprentices as well to kind of help get people in the pipeline as well. So again, to you know, create jobs or more opportunities for people who are just getting started in the field.
Yeah, very cool. A brand new business with a very old profession in a way. So I like that. Hey, you know, I golf just a few times a year and I've not had a hole in one yet. I've been waiting for a chance to win $25,000. And once that presents itself, then I think I'll go for my hole in one. Now you're telling me I might be in luck.
That's right. And a Chicago startup called Digital Golf Technologies is doing just that. They are helping golf courses turn par three holes into hole-in-one contests where players can bet basically $5. And if they hit the hole-in-one, they'll get $10,000 and they can bet 10 bucks for $20,000.
So this happens at charities, but you're saying just any old Monday afternoon round.
Exactly. They are working with over 150 golf courses around the U.S. to really kind of add a little more of a gamified experience to your traditional golf course. I don't know if you've ever done Top Golf, Steve, where you're kind of at the golf range and it's very much like closest to the pin type competitions. You're with your buddies, you're drinking beers. It's very much a game within the game.
I can't hit the ball when I don't drink beers.
But what they're saying is like we want to kind of bring an extra, more casual. They want to sort of recapture the casual fans that they've kind of lost to Top Golf and some of these other golf industries that aren't the full 18 holes. So it's really an interesting kind of concept. They're going to start rolling out some other kind of initiatives around like closest to the pin contest, longest drives, and they're working with the CEO who just got named back in April, who is for Sports Vision, another technology company in Chicago, to really kind of bring tech to these golf courses.
I like it. Really good. Okay, real quick, because Akaris, I know you wrote as well about this. I hear all the time about these smart doorbells where I can be anywhere and see who's at my door. They're not that appealing to me, frankly, but there's a new one coming out of Chicago that you think might be pretty interesting?
Yeah, so this is called the X Chime. It's designed by X Motorola engineers, which, as we know, there's a ton of talent coming out of there.
Right, right.
And it is a very crowded space. There's a lot of people who have done smart doorbells, and as we know, the smart home market just keeps growing. But X Chime has actually made some waves on Kickstarter, on Indiegogo. They were able to raise their campaign goal in less than a week.
And so this is one you think that might stand out a little bit?
At least in terms of early reaction. It seems like people are willing to put their money down to get this smart doorbell, which has a smart garage door opener. It has video abilities, so you can talk to your delivery person, that sort of thing. So at least in early reaction, it seems like
One other thing I wanted to ask you guys about. I think, Jim, you wrote about this, but you know, we always talk about how Chicago ranks and when it comes to tech markets, and there's all this competition. And you said you write a piece about the fact that maybe what we don't look at are the number of quote-unquote exits. And explain for me what exits are and why they're significant.
Right. So a tech exit is when a startup or tech company gets acquired or goes through an initial public offering.
And which is the goal for many of these
companies. That's the goal. And that's how you make your return on to your investors. And basically, Chicago doesn't always stack up to some of its peer cities like Seattle and Boston and L.A. when you think of prominent tech cities. But actually, Chicago's exits, its 10 best exits over the last 5 years, have been better than Boston, better than L.A., better than Austin, and better than Seattle, and pretty much in line with New York, actually, which is traditionally thought of as a tech powerhouse compared to Chicago. So actually, the results are starting to stack up pretty well for Chicago.
I just had – last week we had on the founder, the CEO of Turbo Appeal, which was just taken over, right? And that might be – that's an example, perhaps. But it's because it's a B2B, where Chicago is more of a B2B city, and that lends itself more to takeovers?
And well, what it does is it gets it – kind of under the radar, right? So I think LA has a lot of flashy startups. You look at Snapchat, for example. Chicago doesn't have that kind of like front page newspaper startup.
We don't flash. We don't have flash.
But the results kind of speak for themselves.
Jim Dahlke, Akaris Husted, Chicago Inno. Check it out. A lot more there. And follow the cancer stories coming up all week
long. That's right. More this week.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Right now in the studio, Marty Ozinga, the president of Ozinga Ready Mix Concrete. You see the red and white trucks all over the city and really all over the region. Marty, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, I want to talk about a number of things. Clearly, what's going on in Springfield and the impact on your business, maybe climate in general. But let's start with the fact that this is very much a family-owned business, which started, did I read that it started in a coal yard in the 20s, or what's that about?
Yeah, 1928 in Evergreen Park, Illinois. My great-grandfather got a horse and a buggy and a little piece of property with a rail spur and brought in cars of coal and brought coal door to door for home heating.
And then when did it turn to concrete?
Concrete came in the next generation after World War II. My grandpa and his brothers, they came back from World War II, and they took some of that delivery equipment from the coal business, and in the off-season was the construction materials, and they used that equipment to deliver bags of cement and sand and stone to job sites.
So I'm always interested in, you know, when someone, the younger member of the family, takes it up. You know, did you really dream of being a zookeeper and you were destined to be in concrete? I mean, was it inevitable that you were going to do this?
Well, I wanted to play for the White Sox.
Did you?
But that just,
you probably,
you know,
could today.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think so. But, you know, that was always a dream, but I was never that good at baseball. I mean, I liked going to the games and watching them play, so that was a dream to... But no, I think watching my dad go to work every day and seeing that he loved it, I think that inspired me to want to work. The company always had a great reputation, and it was a place that I thought I might go to work for someday. So.
And so is it different running a family-owned company than it would be, not just publicly traded, but one that's more outside the control just of a family? How does that make things different?
Well, for me, it's what we know. I can't say I've ever ran a publicly traded company, but we're a private business, and there are a lot of family dynamics. I have five younger brothers and a cousin, and we all work hard to get along with each other.
Everyone's in the business.
Everybody's in the business.
Which of your younger brothers is most difficult?
No comment.
Well, that does present a challenge.
Yeah, it definitely does. We know that the odds are against our survival. If you look at from fourth generation to actually making it to the fifth generation, which would be our children, I think it's less than 1% survival rate for that kind of
just for thing. Any business.
Yeah,
in
to
general.
Keep going you know, to the next generation,
right.
And so we see it as something that's almost supernatural. So we work really hard to just to get along with each other. So we really try to find time to really just get along.
Business is good, right? I mean, I can't drive down the street without seeing a Zynga truck.
Yeah, right now I think, you know, we're like a lot of business industries. You know, we cycle with the economy, and right now we're on the good part of the cycle,
right.
I would say, yes, for sure.
Tell me about that cycle. When did it start to pick up, and are you worried that it might go down sometime soon?
Well, 2010 was the bottom, but it's just been a slow recovery, you know, 11, 12, you know. Our hope is that, you know, there might be a couple bumps here, but that there's nothing like the big drop we had in 9 and 10.
Right.
But we think, you know, there's still a lot of upside, both in the area here and, you know, all over the country as far as construction. So.
What's the big chunk of your business? Is it roadways? Is it basement foundations? Or how does your business break down?
Traditionally, residential construction was the big part of it, but you know, that a lot of that, you know, especially with the big recession, that totally went away, and some of that has come back. It's rebounded, but we don't see the suburban sprawl like we did before, and not like a lot of tract homes or even the big homes.
Right.
We just don't see a lot of that. There's some, but not nearly like it was. It's more this residential apartment boom that's really sort of fueled. Yeah, with downtown Chicago, I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of apartment building going on, and a lot of that is this corporate relocations that have happened. So some of the construction is related to that, but a lot of young people just want to be downtown. So we're
a lot of old people want to be downtown,
and those too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that, but yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
And so as I'm thinking about this and talking to you about your business, you know, there are a lot of companies that can go out and create a market, create a business. In a way, you're reliant on other factors, right? On other people building big buildings or not.
No, I would say that's totally true. We always kind of half joke that we can't put concrete on sale and drive more demand.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So we're very much at the mercy of things outside of our control, a larger economy that, you know, we ebb and flow with it, and sometimes it really works in our favor and sometimes not at all.
What's the competition like, the other concrete pourers?
We have one big competitor in town. Prairie is owned by a Brazilian-owned firm, so we're sort of the American company competing with a Brazilian company.
You work that in very effectively.
Well,
right?
You know, we got to use everything we can to, you know, to say who we are. So we're a fourth-generation American company. But there's a lot of other, you know, you get outside the city, there's a lot of other sort of mom and pop,
smaller,
you know,
ones,
smaller
yeah.
ones that are still family held businesses.
But you're moving out, right? You've moved into Florida. You're in Michigan. What does your future look like?
Well, we are always interested in growing the business. We, from the seven of us in our generation, we have 32 kids. So there's a lot of mouths to feed, a lot of shoes to put on these kids' feet. So we need to keep growing the business. But yeah, we recently moved into Florida. We're really excited about that. We think there's a lot of growth potential over the next number of years in
that,
Florida.
That could be the way to get rid of that fifth, the most uncomfortable brother, right? Just find a market in Utah or something.
That might be an idea, Steve. Yeah. You might be onto something.
That's yours for free. Yeah. No worries. Okay. You know, the news coming in, Kim Gordon was talking about the fact that the legislature is, again, in this special session, which I think it's in more likely now than just a regular session. And we talked about the fact that you can't put concrete on for sale in a yard sale. So you're dependent, I would imagine, a lot on what's going on in Springfield. I just wonder what your read of it is.
Yeah, I would say the IDOT road work for us is a decent chunk of our work. I mean, it's probably 10-15% of what we do every day this time of year. Mm-hmm. So that's a fair amount. You know, when we go to hire people and, you know, we look in their eyes and say, hey, we're going to have work for you to do every day. So there is a certain amount of anxiety that comes from, you know, if that were to go away, whether it's on a short-term or a longer-term basis.
How many projects are you working on right now? Do you know off the top of your head?
I would say there's about a dozen.
Right now?
Yeah.
Right. And so, and there's this threat that if they don't have a deal by the end of the week, that those projects are going to be shut down.
Correct. We had the same fire drill last year. They didn't shut down, but, you know, it still creates some anxiety.
So what do you think is going to happen this year?
Well, our hope is that they figure out how to get a deal done by Friday. Otherwise, it'll stop for we don't know how long. So,
what do you think?
I'm optimistic they'll figure it out. But, you know, it's hard to be optimistic nowadays with some of the things that are happening in our state. You know, from a government standpoint, there's just it gets discouraging at times.
Talk to me about the difference, because I can sit here with absolutely no skin in the game and say, of course, they're going to get a deal. They always get a deal. They make these threats. And then when it's time, the construction continues. I can say that. But as a guy who's running a business and has to be prepared for not being on the job next Monday, I would imagine it's a very different scenario.
Well, I think the biggest thing for us, especially, you know, we have an onboarding onboarding day on Mondays where we bring new people this time of year. We have a big hiring push in the spring and early summer. And I like to get in front of those people and really make a commitment that we're going to keep them busy.
Right.
And that's a hard thing when, you know, there's things up in the air like this. You know, people's families depend on going to work every day. I read this morning that 20,000 workers could be affected by this thing. So these are livelihoods of people. They have, you know, families at home that really depend on them going to work every day. So that's it's real in that sense.
Well, Marty Ozinga is the president of Ozinga Ready Mix Concrete. I just wanted people to be introduced to you, so next time they're held up in traffic by the guys, your guys working, they're not so angry.
Yeah, I try to have a good attitude about being held up in traffic, knowing that it's not all bad for us.
But, it's putting food on the table for a lot of people.
That's right. That's right. It's a large part of our economy, and I think it's all in all, it's even though you might find yourself sitting in traffic in Chicago in the summertime, it's not all bad.
Well, listen, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by. Good luck.
Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate I hope you have a busy Monday ahead.
I hope so, too.
Well, maybe not. You're going to be off for the holiday this Monday, right? That might factor into things.
That's true. Maybe a little bit, yeah, but Tuesday then.
Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She is a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. And Randy, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
And she usually works on Sundays, so that's why she's never been, because I was telling you I was in the Pride Parade yesterday, and, well, I just still need a nap.
I need a nap too, but I was working yesterday, not in the Pride Parade, so that might have something to do with that.
There's a story in entrepreneur.com actually about, and we've talked about social influencers, social media influencers, right? These people with a huge following.
Yeah, we talk about them quite a bit actually.
Sometimes in a pejorative way, because they're just sort of peddling their following for cash, which is something I wish I could do.
Yeah, it's pretty smart of them.
All right, so here's the thing. I have a little travel business. And I'm looking for different groups and to travel. I actually had a conversation today with someone who would be considered a social media influencer. She's got 250,000 followers on Twitter.
Oh, wow.
And so we had this conversation about her partnering on a trip with me. So, you know, it was a pitch. And she echoed a lot of the things that came up in this article about what these social influencers are concerned about, what they watch for.
So I think this is kind of interesting, because as somebody that follows a social influencer, you don't see what goes on behind the scenes. And so you think, you know, these men and women are eating delicious food and going on fantastic vacations and wearing designer clothes. And it's actually, you don't see what goes on behind the scenes for them to get that. And they're entrepreneurs, essentially. So they have a bunch of concerns. And while their life looks easy from a social media standpoint, it really isn't. And one of their biggest concerns, I guess, is determining whether or not a brand is a good fit for their image.
Right. And that's it, isn't it? They have to protect the brand themselves.
Absolutely, which sometimes means turning down some pretty lucrative cash deals, I can imagine.
So this idea that they're just sitting poolside and having money thrown at them, well, okay, they are.
They are kind of, but there is a little bit of editing and toning that goes into that poolside image before the money gets thrown.
Is there a university yet where you can major in becoming a social media influencer?
You know, I don't know, but if I find one, I'll probably sign up because it sounds like a life I'd want to live.
Yeah, and Sue... Let me go at it this way. So, as I said, I had this conversation with a woman, and I, having what I know of her, I don't think she wouldn't put herself in that category. She is by her followership. But so what percentage or how many social, quote unquote, social media influencers set out to do it and do it as professionally, and how many of them sort of does it happen organically?
You know, that's a really good question that I don't know. I think a lot of people kind of stumble into it, but I think a lot of people do actively try, and they are kind of running. I know we've talked about some Twitter bots and Instagram bots in the past.
Right, right.
So I think it kind of depends.
Another thing, I forget who I talked to, and it wasn't too long ago when I had their publicity photo, and then they came in the studio, and they didn't look anything like their publicity photo, right?
Oh,
I mean,
no. That's,
well, I mean, I think I used to, when I talked to authors, you know, you'd see authors come in and you'd meet them, and their publicity photos often, they just weren't the same. They were maybe at one time.
10 years older, kind of
and
thing.
Doctored. A lot of them are doctored.
Right.
And that's getting the attention in England. I saw a BBC.com story about sort of, we now think because everything we see is doctored or enhanced that that's the way people look. And there's a real concern there anyway about people marketing sort of unregulated plastic surgery to young girls.
Yeah, especially because a lot of these social media sites like Instagram and Snapchat, their user bases are so young, and these sites, they have filters, and before the images are even filtered, they're photoshopped. And so you see, you know, these celebrities like Kylie Jenner and her, she's admitted to having lip fillers. And so you see kind of these things presented as normal. And so for any impressionable young girl, especially, this seems normal. This seems like something they have to do.
There's an app called Plastic Surgery Princess.
Yeah, and what were the other ones? There was
Little Skin Doctor.
Pimp My Face. Yeah, and these kind of apps where you can upload your photo and do a mock plastic surgery and screenshot it and put it on the internet and pretend it's real life.
But now in England, is there a move to, what do they want to do? I don't know how you would inhibit this or legally fight any of this. It is what it is. It just is kind of where we are these days.
Right. And I think that some of the small things they were talking about requiring, you know, if you're a girl under the age of 18, you need to have a parent's consent. I hope the parents
for
would say
procedure.
No. For surgical procedures. I hope the parents would say no.
I bet they wouldn't all.
Stick with the Photoshop and the filters, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I do. That's why I look so good on Facebook.
Like your author bio 10 years younger?
Exactly, maybe 12. That's Randy Schaefer. She's a digital editor at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for coming by today.
Thank you for having me.